morning and welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make the Elm City tick. Nothing ticks better than Pundit Friday, which we're about to begin here in the WNHA studio with the number one pundits in the media universe. Pundits like Babs Earls Ivy, the very vegan goddess of our grassroots radio operation, the belle of our ball, the managing editor of the Inner City News, and host of WNHA's Love Babs, which had a great episode with Travis the Juice Man.
Yes.
Hitting the case of champagne, Palace. But staying away from the pork.
The salad.
There you go.
And on the special Delta Friday, we have star New Haven independent reporter Markeisha Ricks. And were there any superheroes in the studio? Anyone like that you see?
It's a bird. It's a plane.
You know who I saw here?
Who is he?
I saw present in the studio today. The alchemist of assonance and alliteration. The zealous zapper of xenophobia.
I should have put on a timer to see how long it takes.
Quintessential quipper of quote-unquote quackery. The grandee of grandiloquence and gastronomics. Our prize protector has pusillanimity. And the distinguished duke of diplomacy and detente. The king of conspiracy concoction. Deacon of the dozens. Bodhisattva of battle rap. Missionary of modesty. Mesmerizer of the masses. Shaman of the shoreline. He's the potentate of 360 state. The recognized ringleader of risque repartee. The eighth wonder of the world. Wizard of wise guy waggery. Capo of casual conversation. First name in flame. The daring don of dope deliberation. The sultan of spit. West Indian whisperer of wine. The emperor of explosive exposition. Esteemed elucidator of ebonics. Top tier talent from Trinidad. And Tobago, excuse me. The Daptone deliverer of decency, maximal medium maestro, audacious boldface barista, bop, chess master of chill, the primo practitioner of prop prestidigitation, the beyond just somewhat honorable high priest of hip hop, right reverend of rapture, reigning raconteur of riffitude, sanctified slayer of the slow witted, never late for supper, decorated and indefatigable dunker.
Well, y'all, that's the show.
Of the dinner dishes. The Maximus
we'll be back next week.
Of the Joe Ugly Show in the morning. Welcome, everybody. To our
good morning and then good night.
The inaugural Friday pundits on Facebook Live. Like, I don't know if you got to see Joe while we were introducing him there.
You should have.
But the idea is that we're going to be showing you guys the action as it happens with Harry Jost and Lucie Gelman in the studio.
Although
right
I missed
here.
The mystery of them
right.
not seeing us.
These anonymous faces.
Yeah.
You think maybe Facebook Live is a mistake for radio?
No.
I'm asking this question.
I like it.
Actually,
you do?
Yeah, I like it.
I think I did. As long as the content is good content, you know.
I always wonder why people need to look at the people talking.
Well, no.
Like because, it's about the voice.
Exactly. Because now we're about that society where you want to put a face with the voice.
Yeah.
So you always stream everything at Ugly Radio.
Yeah, I did.
And LaVos and WNHH here from 3 to
they
5. It's always video streamed. We never did. I mean, partly people listen to their cars, but not tons. You know, a lot, unless you plug in your phone radio in your car.
Right.
I mean, but all right. So we're trying something new.
Yeah,
you get to see what you
new
guys
year,
look like.
new challenges.
And what's the news with the Deltas? I heard you were telling me today some big day of the Deltas. It's a national day, and we have a very strong chapter of the Deltas here in New Haven. We've been running these monthly community conversations about where we go next after the Trump election. And is that what you guys are doing tonight? Or you got something else on the agenda?
Oh no, this is pure party now.
We are celebrating 104 years of our existence.
Okay, so this is an annual day, the birthday of the Deltas.
Yes.
And who are
Founders.
The Deltas? What's the full name and who are you?
Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated, 22 founders, 1913.
And these are women from college-educated
black
women?
Collegiately trained women in 1913.
Wow.
22 at Howard University.
Oh, okay.
So.
And now how many chapters you got?
Oh, Lord.
But I mean, you guys have been schooling me on this for some months now, beginning with the election, about how what an important role these sororities play in our communities. We know this charity, as those guys grew up, you also have political action sometimes, right? And community education, getting people involved in the system, giving back, because these are college-educated women in the black community.
Yep.
What role do you see folks playing? Like we talked about these community conversations we have now. How important are these sororities to how the black community in our cities and large and our communities at large are functioning?
I think when you think about, one of our very first public acts as a sorority was also in 1913. And we participated in that women's suffrage march that you've heard so much about here recently. And you know, the divide in feminism around that participation, right? And how there's the intersection of racism as well as
So what happened when the Deltas came to march?
The Deltas, much like Ida B. Wells, who wanted to, you know, this was supposed to be about equality and all having equal rights. but
women getting
the white women wanted us to march in the back.
And why was that?
Because they were racist. They wanted us to march in the back.
And was that because
we risked being expelled from school because we weren't supposed to be out there.
So the Deltas were taking a risk on their own to go march because they were getting in trouble in
school. These young collegians were taking a risk on their own to make a stand for their womanhood, but as well as their
race. To get the vote.
And this is what we are still doing 104 years today.
So they go to the march, and the white organizers say, march in the back.
Yeah, you can march with us, but you can march in the back.
So what did the Deltas do?
They jumped in line in the D section.
What's the D section?
The back.
They were in alphabetical order, and they wanted to march in alphabetical order. Delta starts with D, so we were behind C, but we weren't at Z.
In front of E and F.
We didn't want to be behind the zoological women.
So the Deltas did not follow the request.
We did not.
See, they marked you.
And we haven't ever since.
And haven't ever since.
That's such an interesting moment. You know why? We're getting to that in a minute. And we're not just talking history here, though we are talking history. So this was so they were involved in getting the right to vote. But from the beginning, when women were marching for the right to vote in America within their own ranks, there were divisions based on race.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So now let's fast forward to 2017. A week from tomorrow, on Saturday, January 21st, right? Is that 21st? Lucy Gelman and a million other women in America are going to be marching in Washington, I guess to show, what would you say, Lucy, to show opposition to the incoming Trump administration's stated policies on abortion, women's rights, race, and other immigrants. Is that kind of a fair way to put it? Okay. And reproductive, like they're worried about abortion, de facto becoming illegal pretty quickly in a lot of places of the country, and just the basic protections for women who were abused in the workplace, or sexual harassment. And so the Deltas and other African Americans have taken, I don't know about the Deltas specifically, but there are women leading this march who are of color this time, right? Does that mean we're no longer having the tensions we had in 1913 between black women and white women?
Absolutely not.
Well, what's going on? What's going on?
There's definitely been some tension around in the organizing. It's, I think Lucy probably could speak better to this, that it's been organized mostly through social media challenges, as we do in the 21st century. This same kind of, not necessarily about where we're going to march or what our place is, but where our voice is, and this kind of debate about, you know, should we just all forget some of the challenges? First of all, and Babs and I talked about this last night, black women voted.
We
for
showed up.
Hillary Clinton. We showed up
for Hillary. White women didn't show up for Hillary.
And there's this kind of now.
But did 47% of white women show up for women for Hillary?
I'm sorry. No. How many percentage of black women showed up?
Like, was it 60, 70?
And so, you know, we've been about that solidarity life.
Yeah.
We've been about putting aside, to a certain degree, our issues with race to help the sisterhood. And then the sisterhood, you know, doesn't show up for all of us.
So what's happening with this march to this?
So what's happening with this march is there's this great debate about, you know, the intersection of racism and sexism. And, you know, again, should we shut our mouths and not talk about some of the issues that affect women of color in particular?
Huh. So are people involved in race saying don't talk about race?
They're saying it's a divisive, which is kind of always the excuse, that it's a divisive issue, that we should set aside the race issue because, you know, we need to focus on women's issues. Well, race issues for women of color are women's issues.
Now, is it about not talking about the issues or not talking about racism within the ranks? Because, I mean, what caught my attention as an outsider, white male outsider, was a story in the New York Times on the front page that got 1,400 comments after one day, where there was a 50-year-old white woman from a minister from South Carolina who said, I was all psyched to go to this march. And then I read this blog post from a 27-year-old African-American blogger from Brooklyn. That blogger wrote, now's the time for you to be listening more, talking less. You should be reading our books and understanding the roots of racism and white supremacy. Listening to your speeches, our speeches. You shouldn't be drowning, you should be drowning yourself in our poetry. And then that woman said, well, now I'm not going. She said, how do you know that I'm not reading black poetry? She said she knows being white gives her advantages, but that she's always open to learning more. He said, the last thing that's going to make me endeared to you, to know you and love you more, is if you are sitting there wagging your finger at me. So, like, partly I think we can all agree in this room, before even going further, that that's a ridiculous reason not to go to a march with a million women, because one 50-year-old woman doesn't like what one 27-year-old woman wrote. But what touched the nerve in the article was whether the methods of organizing the group, we're going to alienate people who aren't there yet in understanding the experiences of different of them, or whether this is really an important moment just when you're mobilizing the group for an event to also press issues that get too often ignored.
And this is why there's a President Trump right there, because we want to take race off the table. Don't want to talk about the real issue that is at hand and how it affects certain communities. Because if people were talking race, just like black women showed up proudly at a high number, the true sisterhood would have been, I'm here for my black sister as well.
Yeah.
And I'm going to show up.
What do you think, Babs?
I absolutely agree with that. I think, you know, what happens is black women are always having to choose between race and gender. Mm-hmm. And no one seems to understand that. Right. Even white women, you know, they don't seem to understand that we have to make this choice between race and gender. And they don't respect that. They don't respect it. So they're like, either you down with us or you ain't with us. You can't be black and you can't be a woman at the same time.
Do you think sometimes there are different ways of delivering that message? Like, for instance, a 27.
I think what people are saying is that we're tired of sugarcoating that message. We're tired of trying to make you feel good about talking about race.
Correct.
Like, I'm serving on a board for one of our sorority sisters who started a foundation that's named after her father, who was lynched in Lowndes County, Alabama. And they're talking about participating in a conference that will talk about lynching in its all of its forms and present that in a conference probably somewhere in Alabama. And, you know, one of the white women who's a Southerner who's a member of that board as well, her first thought, and it was a good thought to bring up. I'm glad she said it, but it's one of those things that kind of takes you aback, because she says, you know, well, if y'all are going to be talking about that, y'all are not going to get any white people to participate in that. Because basically white people, and what she said was white people feel guilty enough. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I can't do anything about your white guilt. I can't make you feel any better about the things that have happened.
It's not necessarily the guilt to do it.
Exactly. So we can't not do this very important work of talking and having hard conversations about the civil wrongs in this country in an effort to go forward with civil rights. We can't stop having those conversations because it makes you feel bad.
But is there still a way to deliver a message that in no way holds back, in no way sugarcoats an issue, but isn't
I don't know, because it's a very individualized thing. Some people don't feel some type of way when you say it, and other people do. And I just don't know how to say it.
Young activists, this has nothing to do with race. There's a certain kind of self-righteousness of people in their teens and 20s, and I was one of them, who you say, you should be doing this. You don't understand that. You do this. You don't know that. And you're saying that to people who have lived twice as long as you have, and you could deliver the exact same message without sugarcoating, with being aware of it. You're speaking to another human being who has another set of experiences, and that you're just expressing yourself in a way that isn't lecturing or condemning, but rather just putting it on the table.
But is that actually coming from a perspective of I have a better idea, or I know, or is it because the older person thinks they have an advantage because of age?
It's both. The older person has a responsibility to keep ears open and not discriminate or shut out people who are younger, because
but they often do.
I mean, I learned this so much with my own kids. I remember learning from my own kids. They would often bring experiences home from a very young age and help me look at an issue I've thought about my whole life in a way I never had, especially this whole new way of looking at gender.
Right.
But I also think it works both ways. I think that often young activists fail to communicate with a broader swath of the public.
But that comes like
when the Yippies came. When the Yippies came to 1968 to Chicago and thought it was funny to go on national TV and say we're going to put LSD in the drinking water because we're going to show you straights that you have to chill out.
Right.
That was extremely counterproductive in terms of communicating a serious message about social injustice and trying to convince people, in my opinion. Jerry Rubin was so sure that he knew better than all these uptight straights, who's one of which he became later when he became a yuppie in Studio 54 and all that. He was so sure that he understood better that he thought somehow he was going to affect positive change and actually help people who aren't as privileged as he is by communicating in that kind of way.
I mean, you know, I mean, we'll always have these conversations because, right, when Stokely Carmichael was, you know, down with SNCC back in the day, right?
Trini.
You know, he was diagonal to Reverend King.
Right.
He was diagonal to Malcolm. Like, he was like in the middle, right? Like, you know, Malcolm was over here, Martin was over here, but then here's Stokely saying, you know, we ready for revolution. Ready for revolution.
I would use Stokely Carmichael's role there as the way that's the more effective way to push it. Because like you guys are saying, there's no point in sugarcoating. So they got right in King's face, they got all the established leaders' face, but they really put forward serious ideas about how they felt nonviolence wasn't working, about the importance of having black people lead black movements and not having white people come in and run the show or have too much influence. And I, that was such important stuff. It was uncomfortable. And Martin Luther King himself recognized the power of that argument. And it was difficult. It was uncomfortable. But it was dealt with and had a positive outcome. I'm not sure that you should be listening to this and you're doing that and all that.
You actually sound like to me that you've just made the case for why what this young woman is saying, which is even though she might not appreciate it coming from a 27-year-old, she might appreciate it from somebody who's closer to her age. But, or, you know, I don't know if Bell Hooks needs to say it for you to appreciate it, but she did exactly what the young woman was talking about. Instead of listening and hearing and asking even questions, she basically said, I'm gonna take my ball and back, go home.
Right. And I'm critical of that. I'm not defending. And I think that 50-year-old has as much responsibility as anybody.
But you just said that essentially a younger Stokely Carmichael got up in King's face and he listened.
Right. And this woman should listen too, but I'm not sure the way that woman was delivering the message was obey. It was the same way Stokely Carmichael was delivering the message.
Oh, I beg to differ.
I do as well.
I beg to differ. I think she was delivering the right sort of message. I think, you know, here's the thing. We have to use language to sort of say what needs to be said. It is a communication tool. This young woman used the tools that were at her disposal. Now, listen, if you're going to get pissed off and walk away over some language that you feel some kind of way about, then you wasn't with the cause or down
I'm with you. I'm with you on that.
We can't take that on.
Every sugarcoat for you.
We can't take that on.
Exactly. It's about a movement. It's not about the sugarcoating of the topic. It's about why do you want to go to D.C.? You want to go to show opposition to this individual who you believe is a chauvinist, misogynistic, all that stuff. Why isn't that? If you feel that way, and someone says something about learning a culture, but wouldn't that bring something more to the table of the protest? You understand what I'm saying here? I think it will work if she had listened to her and just say, hey, you know what? Maybe I should learn.
If they were to do what you do so well, actually, Paul Bass, people get mad at you all the time.
All the time.
Right, all the time.
Like, people get mad at you and tell me that they mad at you.
Exactly. it happens to us all. But something that you do and something that our president has encouraged us to do, something that he has done himself, is when you have a disagreement with somebody, you don't go home. You don't take your ball and back, go home. You get to the table with them.
Right.
You sit down and have a coffee with them. And you open up a dialogue with them. Mm-hmm. And not so much for them to teach you. And because, you know, we've already talked about the fatigue of having to educate people. Mm-hmm. But to sit down and have an honest dialogue. Because it's harder to shout at somebody when you're meeting them face to face. When you're sitting down on neutral territory and trying to actually have a dialogue. And say, you know, when you say intersectionality, well, I don't know what that means. I know I have certain privileges, but I don't know what you think that nets me or what you know about my real life.
Right.
Right?
But what do you know about Pundit Friday and WNHH Radio? Your home for community radio, 103.5 FM, LiveCNewHitInput.org. That's what we're doing. Run down the week's news with the best pundits in the pundit universe, Baffles Ivy, Markeisha Ricks, and Mr. Joe Ugly from the Joe Ugly Show in the morning. You know, there's one other thing we haven't talked about here in terms of this upcoming march on the Million Women March on Washington, which sounds like it's going to be awesome. My daughter's going. I'm hoping she doesn't get too lost in the crowd. And those things are really crazy. I've been down with a lot fewer than a million people and not found where I was going. But that's just a nervous parent talking. But, you know, I think about the history discussion about race in these women's events. But what about sexuality? Mm. When you think about the dawn, in the 70s was the second wave feminism, correct? And that's when women were showing how in the new left there was the same kind of male chauvinism in the institutions they were protesting at large in society. But then when it came for the modern gay rights movement to come out of the closet, a lot of feminist leaders were trying to shut them back. And this is why I was getting back to about the 1913 march. In addition to the racism of the leaders who maybe didn't want to see the women up front, I'm wondering if they were also incorrectly and counterproductively believing it would hurt them strategically to have black women too visible in the eyes of the white decision makers whose minds aren't going to change. Because what happened, Betty Friedan and the other feminist leaders tried to keep gay lesbian rights activists out of the marches in the 60s and 70s. They tried to keep NOW from endorsing that. Obviously, all changed. Patricia Ireland became the president. But they were always trying to keep down and keep invisible the gay rights part of the movement, saying that this is going to make it impossible for us to reach mainstream America. Some of the bogus arguments like I was making earlier in the show, right, on the other subject, that are you then therefore not going to be able to reach the mainstream if we let too much come to the fore? And lesbian, we were saying this is all part of the oppression based on gender and sexuality and objectification and the need for all people to have rights. Are you seeing any of that here? Do we have the same divisions or have we now turned a corner with gay rights? That, because I know there's a very diverse leadership of this march. Are lesbian and gay rights going to be front and center as well? Are they going to be comfortable out of the closet, or is there a sense we don't need to talk about that here?
I actually don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, I haven't heard anything contrary, right? Like, mm-hmm. I have not heard in a very long time.
Because these people are serious. These Republicans who got elected, not Donald Trump, but the Republicans who are now in charge, hate gay people. And they hate lesbians.
Oh, we know.
They hate
And gay people better know that. They better know it, and they better organize.
And I think they do, at least
so
my friends.
So what role is this going to have on the women march?
They better show up.
You think anyone's going to be telling them to get...
I think nobody can afford to do that anymore, yeah. Right?
Because one question is what issues do you raise and when, right? So like this week we saw a whole bunch of hearings in Washington. They're running them quick before Donald Trump even becomes president. The Republicans are trying to get his appointees past the confirmation process. And we saw that Jeff Sessions, the attorney general nominee, really sailed through his hearings. And I wonder what role should our senators, Dick Blumenthal and Chris Murphy, be playing. So you saw in one day, Dick Blumenthal was questioning Jeff Sessions. Dick Blumenthal today is coming out against Jeff Sessions. I want to be careful because I think I might have overshot my criticism originally of this, but I'm not seeing a lot of fire on that. So of course, if I'm Jeff Sessions, I'm going to say, here's what I need from you, Dick Blumenthal. Of course, you have to go out and oppose my nomination, but that's not a problem because I'm getting in, right? We got the Republican majority and some Democrats are for me already, Manchin and others. So yeah, if you need to protect your base, go be against me. And when you question me, making clear you don't agree with me, but don't trip me up in a hearing in a way when you have your moment at me on national TV at the key moment. Don't come down hard on me in a way that can actually hurt my nomination prospects. So I believe when I watched Blumenthal, some people say, well, he criticized them. And he said, you know, are you not going to recuse yourself if people bring up impeachment proceedings against the President Trump on the Emoluments Clause, meaning, you know, getting foreign favors through his business dealings. And Sessions handled that so well. You know, I'll uphold the law. And where were you, Dick Blumenthal, when I wanted Loretta Lynch to recuse herself in the Clinton inquiry? And again, I think Blumenthal's right that those are apples and oranges to some extent. But I did not see any of the fire on what an outright racist, barely wearing clothes, Klan robes, opponent of everything involving civil rights.
This is my problem with the Democrats right now, and it's been my problem for the last 8 years, is that they have no will to fight these kinds of things, or they think they're taking some moral high ground.
It takes
a letter from the late great Coretta Scott King to sort of remind people, listen, and this letter she wrote in like 86. So it wasn't like she wrote this in 1956. She wrote this in 1986 when he was, you know, upwards.
Yes. Jeff Sessions was up.
So if this woman, this black woman, had the courage to sort of write this letter, why don't we have the moral imperative to do the same thing? How are we going to rose petal a path to this job for who we already know? There's no question about white supremacy and where he is on that. There's no question.
Like, I'm wondering why shouldn't he just ask him, like, why did you call this black guy who was in your office boy all the time, this attorney? Or, you know, do you still believe that the NAACP is an un-American organization? You know, that the Klan's bad only because they smoke pot? Or what, in this session, the role you've taken against immigrants, do you think that's going to be protecting them when you're still right?
Because the whole point of these hearings are to do this, right?
Or the Civil Rights Division, which has protected the rights of people of color in this country in a dramatic way for the first time over the last 8 years, that's gone contrary to what you consider overreach. Will you? I mean, he did not bear down on him. And I'm just wondering what the tactics are. He might say, well, he's going to get in anyway, don't want influence with them. But I contrast it with Chris Murphy, who's our senator. He's not on the Judiciary Committee, but he questioned Rex Tillerson, who's the nominee for Secretary of State, who headed ExxonMobil. Mm-hmm. And he tore into him on human rights. He pressed him and pressed him. We have the video and the transcript up on The Independent. He did not let the guy off the hook. He and some other senators, he pressed them on the extrajudicial killings in the Philippines, where there's a Donald Trump-like leader named Duterte, who's bragging about how he's just slaying people on the street if he thinks they're drug dealers, who he's killing and locking up. mayors, all political opponents calling everybody a drug dealer, 1,500 people or more just killed extrajudicially. And it's, you know, not just news reports, but our own intelligence agencies and foreign service have ascertained this. And Tillerson kept saying, I'm not making judgments on incomplete information I have. He wouldn't commit to sanctions against Vladimir Putin, even existing sanctions. So Murphy dug in. He didn't just say I'm voting against them. He and others hurt Tillerson so much that he might not get confirmed. And the two things that struck me about that was, A, they didn't do that with Jeffrey Sessions, whom I consider a much more dangerous nominee.
You're right.
But B, I'm wondering about picking and choosing for strategy, because I would actually want Tillerson to be the Secretary of State compared to some of the other nominees. If I were in a perfect world, we can get people who we might agree might have a better approach than foreign policy, might have some of these potential conflicts. But we don't know. He's at least someone who's been very serious.
Has he been
conducting business, running a major industrial corporation, dealing with foreign governments, trying to solve problems? We might not agree with some of his outlooks, but it's not an assumption that he has a life record of trying to undercut the mission of his agency the way Jeffrey Sessions does, the ways that Rick Perry does in energy, the way that the guy in the Defense Intelligence Agency did, just making up information
about. Because we don't know about it, because he's not a public figure. That's the only reason why we don't know about it. But when we look at this man's track record, and we look at ExxonMobil and all the property that they own across the globe, the smallest tract that they have is 1.1 million acres of oil in Guinea that they pump through, and they're the ones, ExxonMobil is who funded the family over there, who is...
So you're saying that because he comes from ExxonMobil, we can't trust him to be separate from their interests?
Because of his policies, and he's actually now starting to lie about what he did and did not do.
So I'm not saying we shouldn't question the guy, I'm just thinking there's a realm, and maybe I'm making unfair distinctions.
No, you're not!
There's a realm of nominees, there are a bunch of crazies who could like destroy the world and everyone's rights. And how we pick in our fights.
But we just have Jeff Sessions' history for the last 40, because he was 40 years of a public figure. But when you look at Rex Tillerson's history in doing business, he's a very shady businessman.
What has he done that was shady?
The buying up of this land, the money that they funded, that ExxonMobil funds through. By the way, oil companies are no longer just oil companies. They're like big laundromats now. They're just laundering money in where other companies, other major oil companies across the globe are owned by the government of those countries. Oil companies are now taking those and they'll buy, like, for example, a refinery here in Texas, the one that blew up last May, and they'll pay $1.2 billion when it's only worth $1.5, only to funnel money back to all the people, back to the countries that they make the deal with to move the oil. It is ridiculous what's going on. Rachel Maddow did a piece on this a couple of nights ago, and it was it's mind-blowing how crooked this man is.
Now, has he ever been found guilty of crime?
No, he's not going to find, just about, like a lot of these
but
guys.
I'm thinking like Putin Rich, like I would, like I would have never, I would have never voted for Richard Nixon, okay? Uh-huh. But you have to acknowledge that he was a shady person, I mean a crook, mm-hmm. when he was a very skilled, experienced person dealing with foreign leaders, and he made some amazing historic accomplishments in his foreign policy and opening up the Soviet Union and China, mm-hmm. and really knew what he was doing. And when he was in that role in conducting foreign policy, he did some horrible things as president. I'm glad he was impeached. I would have never voted for him. But he was a serious person who can conduct that business well. When I look at Rex Tillerson, I see someone who has the potential, if he's in that role, I mean, we should be skeptical, but he might be able to conduct the role. He might decide, I want to use my context, my experience, the way I furthered the interest of ExxonMobil, I might want to further the interest of the others. He might not. He might be terrible. But comparing him to Rick Perry, who knows nothing about energy and wants to destroy the apartment.
We could go down the list of all these nominees. Jeff Sessions wants to go in, we think he's going to go in there
to undo justice at the Justice Department.
Correct.
I'm wondering whether we should be picking our battles.
Listen, I don't think so. I think the Democrats are always trying to pick their battles.
See, that's the problem.
They always end up on the short end of the stick. You know what? You got to go full blast Monty on this deal. And the bottom line is Rex Tillerson needs to be challenged.
Sessions needs to be challenged. Everybody on their team ought to be challenged.
Everybody to the mat. That's right. Because those who get away, guess what? You got 2018 coming up. A lot of those senators, we have elections coming up for those senators in 2 years. You might get one to come over on your side in different appointees. So
like Olympia Snow.
Exactly. Yeah. You're like, hey, you know what?
But you're also going to get Democrats picked off because they have to run for re-election in areas like Joe Manchin where Trump was elected.
Let the chips fall where they may. But you have to have some kind of...
I don't know any a commander in chief in the past, well, God help us where we're going now. I don't know any commander or any general who say, hey, you know what? We're going to sit around and we're not going to worry. We're not going to lose anybody if we go to war. Guess what? This is all our political war. You might lose a seat or two, but let it be something that counts.
But at least for now, you'll be able to listen to Pundit Friday and WNHH at 103.5 FM, blogspot.org. With the best pundits in the world, Markeisha Ricks, Bowser Rolls Ivy, and Joe Eagly. Eagly.
I'm going with it.
What is Eagly?
I have no idea, but it sounds cool. Let's go.
But you know what sounds good? We might have all this bad news in Washington, all this fight. In New Haven, 2017 started with an unusually positive, harmonious development. Now, it's tentative. But, you know, it's a big deal in our city how the unions at Yale and Yale University get along. The reason it matters more than just Yale, it matters that because you're talking about 5,000 approximately blue and pink collar workers for locals 34 and 35 at Unite here who clean the bathrooms, who serve the dinners, who work the computers, who answer the phone, who do the research. And so that's that. They're the biggest workforce in town. So what happens with their pay and benefits affects the whole region, whether their own families, their extended families, the businesses they support, and how other wages are set. But also, as we learned in the last year in 2016, which was a divisive year, when they're not getting along, our whole city and state government are affected. We had trouble passing development bills. We almost had a tax receipt problem and our bond rating lowered, all because of the fighting between Unite Here and their people support them on the Board of Alders and City Hall versus Yale. And at the state level, we had a big fight over governments where the president of Yale and the mayor was not having nice words in public and all that kind of stuff. But then they just struck a deal for a five-year contract, 5 years of labor peace. Now, we don't know if it'll be ratified. Next Wednesday's ratification votes at the Schubert and Battelle Chapel. And until then, the leaders of Local 34 and 35 are meeting in their departments to talk to people to get support for it. But if you have no strike, because remember, we had seven strikes in something like 34, 38 years. If we have no strike, we have 5 years of labor peace. I'm wondering whether at a time when New Haven's going to be focused on responding to new challenges from Hartford and especially Washington, from immigration to budget to urban development to criminal justice, that we might be more united because of what's happening. Yale, any thoughts on that?
I don't know if we'd be more united, but I think it's good that we don't have to have that distraction, as you said, that we can focus in on these things that it's going to roll from D.C.
You know, I was listening to the folks last night at What Now. They were having this conversation about, I think some of this was raised.
This is a forum they had at Common Ground. High School. Yeah, I missed it. How was that?
It was really interesting. It was a lot of people that showed up. And a lot of the legislative body showed up. Pat Dillon, of course, Gary Holder, Robin
Gary
Porter.
Winfield.
I mean, I'm sorry. Ooh.
I know, I'm still Gary saying
Winfield.
It too. I gotta
you know, it's
tongue.
So ingrained in my tongue, right?
Me too. Yeah.
And Robin Porter, Lamar, a whole bunch of folks from different places. And you know, it was funny because they were like, we're all on the same accord here. So there'd be no like, you know, pushback. But, you know, there was this conversation around preparing people when the feds come in and want to snatch up immigrants.
Like they did here in 2007.
Like that's going to happen. It's like people have to be prepared for that. Like, and I think we're in this, I think most people are so comfortable in the belief that, well, we're a sanctuary city.
Right.
It's not going to happen. It's going to happen. It's going to happen.
And especially if Jeff Sessions gets in there, you best believe it's going to happen.
So this week, and the question is, will the federal government go through with a threat by President-elect Trump?
Yes.
And
we have to believe everything that he says.
Allowing the Justice Department to withhold money from the COPS program, which gets us a lot of extra beat cops for community policing, and two other programs in Justice Department, police departments. Will they be playing police departments? By the way, white police officers and police unions overwhelmingly supported Donald Trump in this election, who said, I'm going to support police officers.
Yeah.
Will our police departments be defunded to the tunes of millions of dollars in New Haven because of being a sanctuary, a so-called sanctuary city? It's actually not a term of art, because we don't hate immigrants and try to run them out of the country.
I think it is, because you know what it's going to do? Because once you take money out of the equation for these places that have enjoyed it for as long as we have, you're going to put officers against officers around race in ways that you have not seen before. It's going to create a sense of, there are going to be people who will be like, you know, if we could just round up these immigrants and get them out of here, we could go have things back to the way they were.
Well, Markeisha was at a Board of Ed meeting. They were talking Monday night about getting ready for it. They've had a working group. They've been meeting the Board of Ed ever since the election to talk about how they're going to prepare if agents come to town. What'd you find out, Markeisha?
Nike.
Paul, you wrote that story.
with you. Yeah, I mean, you saw the presentation. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're people are scared. You know, obviously we have a large immigrant population, documented and undocumented, of course. And some people are in families that straddle both lines, right? So, you know, there's a concern of what happens when, you know, or if ICE shows up on a school doorstep.
That's Immigration and Customs Enforcement is ICE.
Demanding, you know, a certain child. Or children, or show me all your undocumented children, like, and get a list, bring them in the office, we're rounding them up and taking them away. And so they're trying to think through what can we legally do? You know, what are our, you know, how do we respond when anybody comes? And, you know, they've kind of expanded to any type of bullying, that sort of thing. Like, what do we do? What is our procedure? You know, we can't break the law. Like, there are legal procedures that they have to abide by, but, you know, and so I think generally the consensus right now is that, you know, it all comes through the superintendent's office. So any requests, there have to be a warrant, I believe.
So you're not coming in our building.
You're not going to come into our building. Yeah. You're not going to show up to, you know, Career High School or something and just raid that high school.
And they're getting all their phone trees together to get families notified of anything, any kind of action that might take place. Now, I'm wondering whether New Haven is going to be singled out. So 2007, we were clearly singled out. We had passed a policy, an ID card, immigrant friendly. Didn't say anything about immigration.
A point on that. Not specifically for schools, but schools are included in this. This came up at the Westville Community Management Team meeting. The issue
you were there
of,
on Wednesday
I
night.
Was there on Wednesday, and there was some talk about, you know, what would the Board of Alders do? Would they make a strong stand? One of the neighbors brought up an issue of, you know, databases with our IDs and things like that. And with the children that we do have, like, you know, are we going to wipe those? Are we going to get rid of them? Are we going to make sure that somebody can't come and request them so they'll know specifically who are undocumented folks are.
I guess looking for Latino names because that's
exactly.
It's a list not just of undocumented. A lot of people have that ID, but that's a really good point. We set up this card to help undocumented immigrants.
And we might be unfairly.
We all need to become Muslim Spanish speaking people.
Well.
Or like the Danes in World War II, they all wore the Jewish star. The king declared.
Like, to me, this reminds me of, I mean, obviously we weren't living during slavery time, but this reminds me of you know, what are we going to do to protect our neighbors? Are we going to hide them in our houses and our churches? Are we going to, like, what are we going to do?
I know my church will.
And the idea that ICE might show up, that sounds like slave catching to me.
It is. And then again, Rex Tillerson, when asked, does he agree with that policy? Oh, he said, oh, you know, he's going to have more, more background on that. And of course, you know, it maybe have to be expanded to other groups. Those were his
expanded
words.
To other
he doesn't do, Secretary of State doesn't do that, Joe.
That was what he was saying when he was asked if he believed in a policy. It was said. It's right there on television.
Because I thought I was asked of the nominees who would actually have to carry out a policy like that.
Well, why don't we just look it up? Because I'm telling you what I saw, sir. What do you think? I got a personal beef with Rex Tillerson?
No.
You might be right. You might be right in that beef. Yeah. I think you made some pretty good points about Rex Tillerson.
No, I'm done with him.
All right. But I'm wondering whether they're done with us, because in 2007, I looked at the FOI, Freedom of Information. I looked at the memos, and we were clearly targeted in 2007 for these raids. They came in, took over 30 people, swept through houses at 6, 7 in the morning, knocked on the doors, and took the people away from their kids and all that. And they did that because a day and a half earlier, we had instituted this ID card, which dangerously allows everybody, including immigrants, to borrow library books. Open bank accounts, we had hoped. It can quite work the way. So they want to get robbed with the money from the work and maybe feel more comfortable dealing with police, especially based on some police procedures. Based on that, the federal government was so mad they came and terrorized the whole community. People were locking their doors, not coming out of the house in Fairhaven for days after that. It was like a ghost town and all the fear. And now lawyers helped fight back and these people stay in the country. But something has changed since 2007, which is we were at the front edge then. We were leading on this sanctuary city idea. Now there are hundreds of cities like us and entire states. Utah, which is a red state, has it written in law that they are a sanctuary state. Mm-hmm. That's Mormons believe in that. And it's mostly liberal cities, but big cities, L.A., San Francisco, New York, they have these sanctuary policies too. So while I think we do need to be prepared, and it might be very widespread, and boy, that was so interesting what you heard at the management team meeting, Markeisha, they're wondering whether we've created a partial database for them with this card. And there's going to be fighting. I'm not sure we're going to be singled out the same way we were before. I sure hope not, and we have to be ready. But the landscape has changed in America. It's that divided country that now more and more people are for gay marriage, they're for civil rights on the coasts, in enclaves, in other communities. for immigrant rights, and then other people just see the world completely different and are against them.
I wonder, though, given our, you know, that we are so small and so liberal, if you will, on so many fronts, whether it's immigration, gay rights, that we're so liberal that, you know, would we be singled out as an example?
But are we more liberal than Berkeley or more liberal than LA or
but they're
more
bigger.
Liberal than San Francisco?
They're bigger.
So you think it's easier because we're smaller?
I think we're smaller, and I think we have an element of elitism to us. And I think that, you know, it's a doable city. If you're going to do that kind of thing, that you would do it in this kind of city, right? And I don't put nothing past the moment that Trump was elected. Was the moment that I knew that all bets were off about everything that I believed and knew about what could happen in this country to people.
Mm-hmm. A part of it is how they're going to define sanctuary city. One is more when the local police and state police refuse to cooperate with forwarding information and detaining non-violent suspects, non-felonious accused suspects in the lockup for extra days so the feds can come see if they need to deport them. And that's a statewide policy. We have that in New Haven, but that's a statewide policy. And Dan Malloy, our governor, has been public, kind of getting in the face of Republicans and say, yeah, we're going to continue to do that. So I could see them wanting to take a shot at Malloy, whom they hate, like Mike Pence, the vice president. Malloy was his foil. Pence refused to take in the Syrian refugee family. And Malloy said, well, we'll take him and brought him to New Haven. So I can see your argument there. If they decide they want to go after Malloy, what better city in Connecticut
and
to come to New
Haven?
And
we have to understand, Paul, these people are very petty, right? Like they're very petty,
yes.
And they're not going to forget these so-called injustices to their person. They're not going to let that go. They're going to remember that after all of us or some of us have forgotten that little so-called, you know, insult to them, and they're going to remember that. And I bet you it's going to move to the top of their list, right? Because they've said over and over, he ain't going to forget this. Oh,
right.
He's never going to forget this. He's going to be dealt with. And people are acting like that's just some words. Like, this is how they operate.
But according to Kellyanne Conway, we just can't follow his words. We have to follow what's in his heart.
Well, we're never going to forget that you're listening to Pundit Friday on WNHH Radio, 103.5 FM, live stream, New Haven, org. We're running down the week's news with the best pundits in the media universe, Babs Rosavi, Markeisha Ricks, and Joe Ugly. Hey, what'd you think about what New Haven's government lawyer did this week? He came to a public hearing. Tom Breen had an excellent article about it in the New Haven Independent. John Rose, City Corporation Council. And they were doing some minor fund transfers. Michael Smart, city clerk, said, I need $15,000 transferred from an existing fund to another fund so I could use it in case I get sued by my deputy or having a whole dispute. I put on administrative leave, and I asked the state to look in allegations. He messed up some documents. She's saying it was a vendetta on how to run the department, whatever. And the city's corporation counselor said, don't put her on leave. Just, I think it's not a test to her. Give some Brett Manhattan, bring her back. And the clerk did not follow that advice. And the clerk's now saying, I think she might sue me. I want to be ready. And you're not going to be my lawyer, obviously, so I want to have some funds for a lawyer. And the alders agreed with him and said, that's good planning. You've kept your budget in great shape. They don't go over budget in that department. And you're taking steps now not to go over budget. John Rose, the city lawyer, said, you shouldn't be hiring outside lawyers if you're not following the advice of the corporation counsel. We're your lawyer. And if you don't follow our advice and you get sued, you should be on the hook for that money. And that created a big discussion about what are the individual responsibility of department heads when you're working for government and whether taxpayers should be paying in that case. And readers overwhelmingly, the Independent, who are not in favor of John Rose, the Hart administration, agreed with Rose. Like overwhelmingly, at one point when I checked, it was 0% saying that they should be able to be having taxpayers pay for their lawyers in those cases. But other people in the alders felt like you have to be able to make some independent decisions because Mike Smart, his lawyer is the corporation counsel, but he's not elected to work for the mayor. He's an independently elected constitutional official in New Haven, which is, and this has no to do with him or whoever has the job. It's kind of bizarre that we elect our registrar, our voters, a town clerk, in my opinion. But we do. And they're they're elected executive officers. Do you guys have any thoughts on this? Who's right?
I'm with John Rose. I am the city corporation counsel. This is my job. I get to advise on things of legal matters. Uh-huh. Now, we are telling you what to do so we can protect you in this role. But you're not listening to us. But yet you want to go get your own attorney. Then that's on your dime.
Mm-hmm. Joe?
Makes sense to me.
All right. Does it make sense to you about another letter Martin Looney wrote this week? Martin Looney's staff and Martin Looney read an article in the Independent.
like, hey, Joe, what do you think? Well, you know, from now on, I know the fifth. F-I-F, fifth.
Martin Looney, our state senator, president of state senate, he and his staff reacted to an article in The Independent about how, for more than a year, the state keeps missing promised deadlines to put GPS systems operable on city buses so that, you know, these buses are late all the time. So we can at least know while we're waiting.
So we'll know that they're late.
Or where they are, when they're coming, how long. Do you need to make other arrangements? I've been waiting for
buses. Or that you don't stand out in the rain for like an hour.
I've had situations
where
I would be able to have gotten somewhere if I had known the bus was 25 minutes late, that kind of stuff. And they kept promising it to us. We agitated for it. We were the one city saying our bus service thinks we need all these changes. So they said, okay, we'll give GPS, but they gave it to Hartford first. And now they said, for all these reasons, we can't give it to you for more than another year. And they keep saying you'll have it by this date, and then they keep missing it. So Looney wrote a letter to the DOT, Department of Transportation Chief James Redeker, saying, what's the deal with GPS? This is ridiculous. Why is it taking so long? But he said something else, which I never knew. He talked about how New Haven gets shortchanged on bus service. You know, the governor and his DOT chief, Redeker, they come to Connecticut, to New Haven, almost every month or two to make an announcement about trains or roads. Fairfield County commuters taking their line coming out of New Haven train station, or people from the suburbs riding in on our highways, and how they're going to spend all, they spend all this money and come be ahead of budget, fixing more people riding. They've never once come for a press conference of bus service because bus service is so bad and they're responsible. And we've, the mayor of New Haven has called it a civil rights injustice. Our people, New Haven did more than any other city to elect this governor. And since he's been in there, he's been pleaded with to do something about bus service. And they have a study in a few more years. They might improve some of the totally outdated, unusable schedules so that people can't commute to jobs and all kind of stuff. But and so Looney pointed out that in New Haven, we have 23% of all bus ridership, but we have only 7% of the routes. Now, you compare that to Hartford, they have 35% of the ridership, but 28% of the routes. The reason it's not equal is that sometimes people are rural, it's not as dense. Of course, they're going to need more routes without as many people on the buses. But that number stuck at me, 7% versus 23%. That kind of explained it to me. We have 10 million annual rides in New Haven. I know that, like, when that bus is really late, and then nobody can sit, and then it takes forever to every little stop. And it's just crazy. And then, you know, the people, they think the day ends at 5:30, and people aren't going to need to get home from work a little later or go out at night, God forbid, in New Haven and support the nightlife. Or people go to jobs that aren't directly on the hub to the green, but maybe North Haven or Hamden, and then you wait hours to get a bus. You want to go West Haven to North Haven to the shops there to work. I met one woman, she just can't go on the weekends. Can't even do the 2.5 hour per way thing. I don't understand why this continues.
And we always keep hearing this conversation about New Haven being an economic powerhouse for our state. And it would seem that the transit issue would be a part of.
Should be hand in hand with any development.
It should be hand in hand with that.
You
want
to build all these apartments and places to live, but yet you don't want to. You don't want to invest in mass transportation.
Well, they say we do the trains, so they did the new bus station, State Street, that helped make 360 State Street Tower get built, and they had the 100 College Street, Alexian Building. Say, well, that's good because it's near trains, but buses is what gets me, and I believe it's because the disproportionate number of people who ride the bus in cities are black and poor.
I think you are absolutely right. And, you know,
even though they voted overwhelming numbers for
I think more people would ride the buses, particularly from my neighborhood, if buses were.
Oh, I know. For mine, it's totally true.
It's more reliable.
If they had real service after 5:30 going to my neighborhood.
If they have real service, period. You know, I have the kids over at the station, and so often they want to come, but they don't know exactly when the bus. They have an idea of when it's going, but no one has a. Okay, it's going to be here at 7:15.
So how are you going to get back? How are you getting back to 360 State after the show? You got to go 2 whole blocks to your apartment.
And, you know, I need a skateboard.
You're going to hover. You got to hover.
Skateboard.
He's got the beard now. Joe Ugly's got the beard. And we
and
all know.
And it is sexy.
Unanimous raves for that beard. There is no difference of opinion. What about the hoverboard?
I might get one.
All right. Well, stay tuned till next time. I'm Pundit Friday to get the answer to Joe Ugly's hoverboard and see what other names and other
float
new
his way
laurels
up there
we have
next,
for
next Friday.
Thank you for joining us today on Dateline New Haven. Thanks to Pundits Babs Rolls Ivy, Markeisha Ricks, and Joe Ugly. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now, we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight.
Thank you for Lucy for like handling all the live.
That's Facebook Live. Thanks to Lucy Gelman. So book your flight and fly free with us all weekend long at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio, and have a restful, transcendent Shabbos to all.